Hello and welcome to Everyday Oral Surgery. This is your host, Dr. Grant Stuckey. I am an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in Denver, Colorado. The goal of this podcast is to connect, learn, and inspire. In this podcast, you'll be hearing from OMS surgeons all over the globe discussing ways to improve the practice of oral and maxillofacial surgery. Most information shared in this podcast will be based on personal experience and opinions, so please supplement what you learn here with approved research studies. If you are a regular follower of the podcast, please go to our website, everydayoralsurgery.com, and register to receive newsletters and find links to our social media accounts. Most importantly, if you would like to be interviewed on the podcast or know someone who you'd like to hear from, or if there's a topic you'd like to hear about, please email me at grantstuckey@gmail.com. Without further ado, please enjoy today's episode. All right, welcome to another episode. Today I'm with Dr. Andrew Yenzer. He is an oral and maxillofacial surgeon practicing in North Carolina. Andrew, thank you so much for joining us again on the podcast.
Wonderful to be back, Grant. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, this is great. You've provided a lot of good informational medicine type topics, and we thought we'd kind of keep that theme going and talk a little bit about the liver. So what do you got on tap for us today?
Well, so today we wanted to talk about liver and hepatology, and similar to the other podcasts, you know, the first kind of half will be just talking about some of the basic understanding of the liver, kind of more focused on laboratory evaluations and some of the physiology that I think it's important to understand before moving into how are these patients worked up, how are they staged, and then how do we treat and deal with them in our practices, particularly a discussion of intraoperatively and certain medications, what to use, what not to use, things to be aware of, and postoperative management as well. So a little bit, again, half geared toward, helping our residents and people preparing for board exams, and hopefully at least a reasonable refresher for those of us practicing.
Yeah, that's terrific. Well, I'm excited to kind of hear what you have to say and learn some more about the liver. So
awesome.
Where should we start?
Well, in general, and I'm not going to go into too much detail because this is stuff we've all looked at a little bit, but the liver has a lot of different functions. Just to refresh and, you know, throw some words out there, you know, it performs a lot of functions as it pertains to sugar storage and metabolism of glucose. So with things like gluconeogenesis and gluconeogenolysis and just glycogen storage. It's a big detoxification center in our body. It also produces bile. It produces a lot of various proteins and lipids to include all the coagulation proteins, except factor 8 and von Willebrand's, which were produced in the endothelial cells. You know, it's that common question I see missed a lot where people get it tripped up with what are the vitamin K dependent factors in the liver, which are proteins 2, 7, 9, 10, and protein C and S. But actually, all the coagulation proteins are made in the liver, except for factor 8 and von Willebrand's, and the major protein albumin. So there's many different disease states, obviously, that can directly or indirectly affect our liver. We have things like viral etiologies, all the various hepatitis problems, cytomegalovirus, other things like that. We can have autoimmune conditions. We can have metallic metabolism diseases like hemochromatosis and Wilson's disease. We can have neoplasms, malignancies, and then a host of genetic conditions that can affect this system. So where do we start? I actually want to start with bile and kind of what bile is and how it kind of flows through our bodies, because then trying to understand how to work out where and what's going on with a problem, often bile can be very elucidating. So red blood cells, if you remember, live an average of about 120 days. And we have a term that we use to describe older red blood cells called senescent. And senescent red blood cells, that's our doctor vocabulary word that means aging. And particularly as it pertains to biology, it means cells that are no longer actively dividing, but metabolically active. So it's a way we have of saying kind of older cells that might be on their way out. And that's why we're using that word to describe kind of these older red blood cells. So when we have senescent red blood cells, they're destroyed by the spleen and the liver, generally, spleen being kind of the major one. I kind of think about it like the furnace of the body. And there's a lot of macrophages in there, right? We think about all those histology of the spleen and, not too pertinent to this, but there the red blood cell is broken down. And we get hemoglobin broken down into both heme and globin. And globin is turned into amino acids, and the story kind of ends for globin there. The heme is broken down into biliverdin and ferrous iron. Think Ferris Bueller if you're old like me and, you know, used to love the movie Ferris Bueller's Day Off.
Sure.
So the biliverdin is then turned into bilirubin by an enzyme called biliverdin reductase. And bilirubin is yellow. So at this point in the body, we have unconjugated bilirubin. And it is brought to the liver by albumin. And I think about albumin like the Uber of the body. It's our main way of moving proteins and molecules around. And it loves binding unconjugated bilirubin. So under normal conditions, there should be very little to almost no free unconjugated bilirubin in the plasma, something that we can try to measure with certain labs, as we'll get into. In the liver, it then gets conjugated, goes through a bunch of different metabolic pathways, and then it's passed into the biliary system, which kind of collecting ducts for the waste of the liver. They kind of flow down. It goes past the pancreas and gets dumped into the duodenum. And here, bacteria do some stuff. It's not really important. A little is resorbed, some is excreted, and a small amount is in the urine, which is why our urine is yellow. And if bilirubin builds up in our body, our skin turns yellow. And that is called jaundice. So jaundice, we have that condition where not only the skin turns yellow, but the whites and sclera of the eyes and the mucous membranes can also turn yellow or yellow-orange, because that's the color of the pigment. And on our history and physical, I think it's helpful to touch base. There's a phrase that most of us often use or maybe copy and paste and don't think about a lot, and that is anecteric. So oftentimes in that pre-templated H&P of the eyes, it'll say anecteric sclera. And that means without jaundice. But it's important to note that jaundice is kind of not the only color change that can be associated with an elevated bilirubin level. Excessive amounts of this pigment can turn the urine darker, particularly for conjugated bilirubin. And a lack of the pigment getting to the GI tract from, say, a blockage can result in very pale or clay-colored stool, because the stool often gets some of its characteristics and pigmentation, again, from that biliary system kind of emptying there. So we can have different kind of some color changes if that whole process is off or something is wrong with it. And if we get those bile salts building up in our skin, we can get a very intense itchiness or pruritus from that deposit. So normally our blood levels of bilirubin are about 0 to 1. The units don't really matter. It's milligrams per deciliter. And when you get this lab value, which is either a normal component of a complete metabolic panel, or, you know, you can order it as a separate lab, it usually comes as a total bilirubin. That is a combination of direct and indirect, though you can order separate labs to see that. And when we say indirect bilirubin, that is referring to unconjugated before the liver, and a direct bilirubin is looking at conjugated levels. So if we have a problem and that lab is particularly high, we can then ask for a breakdown to kind of start to identify, is the problem before the liver or afterward? And that, along with some other labs, helps kind of create a better differential for what's going on with the patient. Still with me? Any questions so far?
Oh, yeah, that's really helpful. So the eye that has yellowing is icteric, or what do you call that?
Yep, an icteric sclera.
Okay.
And, what an extremely poignant thing that has always stuck with me for my career was a extremely experienced internal medicine doc who had been doing it for 30 or 40 years. And he said, there are a few things that scare him as much as an asymptomatic patient, older patient generally, who comes in with asymptomatic jaundice, because oftentimes it can be the presenting symptom of some sort of malignancy of the biliary or liver tracts. And, you know, they feel fine. They have no problems, but they are just wake up and, you know, develop particularly aggressive jaundice. And he says oftentimes those are the patients that, you know, feel fine, but you kind of do a workup and find out they only have a few months to live. So I was kind of, especially in older folks, you know, beware the asymptomatic jaundice patient and make sure they get a full workup pretty quickly.
Good to know.
Thinking more about what could increase those different types, those direct or conjugated or indirect and unconjugated levels. So let's start with unconjugated bilirubin. And, you know, we can use the term as well, hyperbilirubinemia is a little bit longer phrase for it. So things that could increase our unconjugated bilirubin levels. Well, if we have anything that causes a lot of destruction of red blood cells, which can be a host of hematology issues like hemolytic anemia, then we can get a buildup of that because we kind of increase the amount of hemoglobin that's floating around and, you know, kind of goes through the breakdown process, or anything that decreases the conjugation of bilirubin by the liver. For example, in congestive heart failure, this can reduce the blood flow to the liver enough where you actually aren't getting that circulation to the liver, and then you get an increase in the unconjugated bilirubin. So, and I'm just touching on a few things in general. There's a lot of different things that can cause these. Just trying to give some examples so folks can build kind of a mental picture with it. Okay. Conversely, what about conjugated bilirubin? What can increase that? Well, usually it's things after the liver. Blockages in the biliary tract, things like gallstones. You could have a tumor that pushes on that duct and tract. Sometimes direct liver issues like hepatitis, drugs and toxins, all sorts of things. And then don't forget, we always have the myriad of weird genetic diseases like Dubin-Johnson and Roeder syndrome and a whole host of various things. So now we kind of understand bile a little bit and the flow around our body and how it pertains to bilirubin. So let's move on to some liver function tests, or LFTs. So these are often incorporated as part of a complete metabolic panel. If you order a CMP, this will come. But you know, you can also order usually a panel for these separately. They often include bilirubin as a total, like we talked about. Usually you have to ask for a breakdown. They also include things, and we'll go through these, AST, ALT, alkaline phosphatase, and usually a mix of proteins like albumin, total protein, and lactate dehydrogenase. And I want to start off and focus on AST and ALT and what they are. Well, ALT is technically alanine aminotransferase, and AST is aspartate aminotransferase. And these are enzymes in liver cells that leak out with damage. So it's kind of a misnomer, because we always think of, what are LFTs? They're AST and ALT. Well, not really, because these enzymes are not really related to the function of the liver. They are enzymes that simply present when there is acute inflammation and damage. So if you actually wanted to, you know, kind of think about what proteins would be a much better evaluation of the function of the liver, well, coagulation tests. Because like we mentioned, the liver makes all the coagulation factors, except for factor VIII and von Willebrand's, as well as protein measurements like albumin. Those are much better proxies for actually trying to figure out how our livers function. And you remember the PT, the lab we use to measure the extrinsic pathway for coagulation. That's a much more good indicator of acute liver damage because it's rapidly degraded. The half-life of factor VII, for example, is 5 hours. Most of those coagulation cascade proteins have very short half-lives. Albumin, conversely, tends to be more decreased in a chronic picture. So, you know, we can kind of make some guesses or give us some diagnostic insight depending on, you know, if the albumin is decreased versus some of those other more short products, like, you know, if they're INR and PTT and PT are elevated. And we have a term that's generally used when we're talking about LFT elevation, and that's transaminitis. So if you see somebody or hear somebody talking about transaminitis, they're usually talking about an increase in AST and ALT. So when you have elevations in these, they can signal liver damage or alteration in bile flow. But it's important to think and, you know, remember that these are not solely found in the liver. And AST is also kind of found in things, and ALT a little bit, like cardiac cells, muscle cells, the brain. So if you have kind of generalized damage to other systems, there can be other reasons they elevate. ALT is more specific to the liver. So it's a more specific marker of liver inflammation, whereas AST tends to bump and increase more when you have damage to these other kind of organs or cell lineages. And there are some diagnostic information and some ratios that you can think about and glean information from these. Normally, these ALT is 0 to 35 and AST is 0 to 40. I just think about both as about 0 to 40. And we kind of say when you're talking about a mild elevation, then that's usually about 2 times the upper limit of normal. And for example, a lot of our patients that we may take care of, well, and they, if they have anything from mild to moderate liver dysfunction, they may live at around an AST and ALT of about twice the upper range of normal. So about, you know, 70 to 100. And that this might be where they exist. So remember, think ALT is more specific to the liver, and AST is in the liver, but it's also in other places. And as we kind of think about ways that the liver can get damaged or have dysfunction, I kind of think about three categories. The first one is hepatocellular. We can have actual just damage to our liver cells. Cholestatic, we can have primary injury or blockage to the bile duct. And, you know, if the outflowing tract from the factory gets blocked up, things build up and the liver gets damaged. And then we have infiltrative processes where the liver cells are replaced or invaded by a variety of bad things. And, you know, as we talk and think about AST and ALT, we kind of file those away under hepatocellular because we said that they can leak out when there's damage to hepatocytes. And we have some ratios that can be helpful in their diagnostic information. For example, ALT tends to be, as it's more liver specific, it can increase greater than AST when you have things like viral hepatitis, fatty liver disease, which we'll talk about, like non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. Whereas AST tends to increase more than ALT in a 2-to-1 ratio for alcoholic hepatitis, cirrhosis, and other non-hepatic sources. And we'll kind of get into if there we're talking 15 times the upper limit of normal and somewhere, you know, in the 1,000 range, then we're starting to talk about severe acute liver failure, which we'll kind of get into. Any questions so far? I'm not sure when the last time you kind of looked at a liver panel or thought about that or maybe got them on a consult back or.
Oh, that's a good review. That ALT is more specific and AST is liver, but also various muscle kind of damage in our body.
Yeah, it's in general, these, and obviously, you know, I'm not an internal medicine doc by profession, but working these up and kind of trying to figure out where the issue is, I think, you know, a lot of the listeners have probably done general surgery rotations, and it can be really tricky to figure out those patients and where the blockage is, and, you know, if they need a cholecystectomy. Some of those can get quite tricky in terms of more in-depth surgical workup and kind of what's going on with the whole system and where is the problem. An interesting thing is, as we talk about liver damage and issues, obviously, like, the list of drugs that can cause these problems is really long. A very interesting one is actually Augmentin. Augmentin can cause a pretty impressive hepatocellular injury. I wasn't aware of this until I was doing some research for this, and I came across this kind of stuff, but it's a very common one from when they can identify what drugs cause it, and it can manifest up to 8 weeks after being taken with an average of about 3 weeks. And the patient then would present with fever, fatigue, itchy skin, pruritus, like we talked about, jaundice. They don't know the exact reaction and cause, but it's theorized to be an immunoallergic reaction. So that once in a career thing when, you know, you're taking care of a patient and give them antibiotics postoperatively and they show up to your office a few weeks later and present like this, a liver patient with jaundice and all these issues, consider, you know, remember, Augmentin does have the capability of causing something like this.
Boom. Pro tip by Andrew Yenzer.
That one time in your career it happens. Yeah. So diving just a little deeper into the really bad stuff, if AST and ALT are 1,000 or higher, remember the normal is 0 to 40, and we have an increase in our INR to 1.5 or higher, indicating, again, some liver dysfunction. And we also have hepatic encephalopathy, which we're going to talk about, then by definition, we have a severe acute liver injury. We can have this if the hepatic vein becomes blocked, the outflow of the liver. Remember, everything kind of goes through it, does all its magic, gets detoxified, and that whole blood kind of flowing through then eventually empties back into the vena cava. And if that outflow tract gets blocked, that's called Budd-Chiari syndrome. And that's what it is. If something blocks that, then the blood can't flow out of the liver, it backs up, and the whole system falls apart. And common things that cause that, we can actually get clots or blockages in that area. Also with folks who have myeloproliferative disorders like polycythemia vera or essential thrombocythemia, you know, or something where we get a very thick, too many blood cells of a certain type, that can cause blockages there. So that's what Budd-Chiari is. You just get a blockage there. It backflows in the liver and you've got damage and problems. Within the liver itself, the bad infections, again, hepatitis, HIV, CMV, Epstein-Barr virus, and all sorts of drugs like Tylenol or acetaminophen overdose, infiltrative malignancies. Then we can also have inflow problems from the portal vein or hepatic artery, or severe outflow problems. So we have to think about the inflow and outflow, both in terms of the products as well as the blood. And, you know, if you chop any one of those off or kind of block it up, then obviously you can have some major issues. So let's kind of move to some of those other labs that we talked about that to think about and that will be on that panel. And the first one I want to talk about is alkaline phosphatase. And this is present throughout the body, but it happens to be concentrated in kind of the liver, kidneys, gallbladder, intestine, and bone, as we know from oral pathology. The normal value, 0 to 30. So again, I kind of file these away with liver things, like 0 to 30, 0 to 40 is pretty normal. And so what causes elevations in alkaline phosphatase? Hepatobiliary pathology, like we talked about. Really anything that blocks the outflow from the gallbladder will kind of cause an increase. So I think about it more as a gallbladder and biliary tract specific enzyme. But remember, you know, laterally thinking, what else in oral pathology, you know, back to dental school days, has alkaline phosphatase? Well, when we talk about bone metabolism, alkaline phosphatase is a marker for increased metabolic activity of bone. So a lot of the different bone things that we talk about that manifest in the face may present with elevated alkaline phosphatase. I always remember Paget's disease because it's the only one that will present with elevated alkaline phosphatase, but essentially all other normal laboratory values. It's funny the you know, parallels that we draw from all those days going through oral path in dental school.
Yeah, it's good to review that for sure.
And so along with alkaline phosphatase, we also kind of think about GGT, or gamma glutamyltransferase. It's another enzyme here. It's mostly in the liver, and it's just another marker of liver injury, and it helps us understand alkaline phosphatase. If both of those are elevated, the problem is usually in the gallbladder or biliary tract. But if GGT is elevated and alkaline phos is normal, then it generally indicates the problem is the liver. So really, you know, we have to look at this constellation of everything. And again, you know, we're not experts in this, but, you know, I think some basic understanding just helps, you know, to direct it. So when you get that complete metabolic panel and you're looking at it, you can at least start to file those things and think about what elevations might indicate or mean in our patients.
I don't know if are you going to touch on gallbladder issues and how that affects the liver, or is that a different topic?
I would say that's more of a different topic. Okay. We're about to dive kind of more into just now the liver specific. I'm happy to shoot off the cuff or whatever. If you have any specific questions or things you want to touch on.
Well, just the basic things, I mean, that we usually see in general surgery, like you get gallstones and how that causes what, mechanical backup. And then how does that affect the liver? Maybe you could explain that. Hey, real quick attention to all residents and fellows who graduated within the last 6 months. KLS Martin is offering one-time sale pricing for newly graduated oral and maxillofacial surgeons. The sale includes discounts on a Vianair ChiroPro with 5 handpieces, the Spectra G6 headlight, which is awesome, oral surgery instrumentation, and in-office bone graft kit components. This is an incredible deal, so don't forget to ask your KLS reps about this. So please enjoy.
Sure. Like our general surgery rotations, or if you have these patients on medicine, again, shooting from the cuff here, team. So if I misspeak a little bit, just, you know, forgive me. It can be a very tricky diagnostic picture because of the different types of blockages, the fact that they can be transient and move throughout the system. And so the gallbladder, we have that little pouch that kind of sits down from the liver. It kind of creates bile and empties that bile into the common biliary tract that tracks down, and, you know, a bunch of the pancreas kind of flows into it, and it dumps into our duodenum of the small intestine. And when we start to get malfunction of that normal kind of physiology, generally people can get a couple different things. The first of which is cholelithiasis. We can get stone formation there. And sometimes that can be asymptomatic. Sometimes people just have a gallbladder that is full of stones. But if enough of those stones build up, then sometimes those stones can then fall into the kind of sewer system, the major outflow tract, and cause blockage. That can also be either associated with inflammation, cholecystitis, or those can become mixed and the blockage can then cause inflammation, or there can be an infection in other cases of the gallbladder itself. And part of the tricky part think comes into those stones can sometimes pass to some degree, but they can also be kind of transient. They can move up and down that system, creating symptoms that come and go. If that gallbladder is full of stones, it can actually compress onto the outflow tract of the bile duct itself, something called Maritzi syndrome. So the actual tract might not even be blocked, but you're getting this outside force pressing on it to cause essentially an obstruction. And these patients, you know, the folks you work up who may need a cholecystectomy, their gallbladder potentially removed. Oftentimes this involves an ultrasound. If there's pus in there and they're not stable enough for surgery, they may drain off the pus with a kind of percutaneous needle-guided procedure, or even put a drain kind of to the abdomen outside to help drain things off in more acute phases. I remember getting different diagnostic workup scans, like a triple CT scan or a HIDA scan. There's different modalities that you can do to try to give somebody contrast materials to see, does it go through the whole system? And if there's a blockage, where is it? To help make that determination about, you know, do they need their gallbladder out versus do they need something like a GI docs intervention, like an ERCP or a procedure to kind of try to stent open the sphincter of Oddi and kind of the lower stages of that. So I think that's about the extent that I could give you off the cuff. Any particular more that you want to kind of dive into?
So if a gallstone builds up, comes out of it goes through the cystic duct and then into the common bile duct, that's when, because the hepatic duct also meets up and then forms the common bile duct with the cystic duct. So if common bile duct gets blocked, then that's when you start seeing more liver type backup and damage. Yes.
Yeah. I think about the liver has a bunch of these sewer systems out of it, you know, different ducts that kind of flow inferiorly and coalesce. And along that collection of sewer ducts, we have the gallbladder. And you're exactly right. They all kind of meet and form the kind of common bile ducts. So if there's blockage there in a stone below that, then the whole system backwards gets backed up into the liver itself. You'll get, you know, everything we just talked about, a transaminitis, elevation, liver damage. Exactly.
Got it. Okay, good. Thanks for taking that quick side note there. Let's get back to the liver then.
Now, hopefully I probably offended some general surgeons, so I apologize to my colleagues out there, but it's really tricky working those patients up, especially if sometimes it's clear cut, but sometimes it's not. So try to, when you're working with those folks and taking care of those patients, really try to spend a lot of time learning and figuring those things out. So what I want to do is I want to jump now into some specific pathophysiology that we'll see with some of these liver problems, especially as we get more advanced. So first, cirrhosis, right? A term we're probably all familiar with, a pathologic dysregulation of the homeostatic mechanisms that control the liver, resulting in scarring and permanent damage. So we have a kind of process going on where we have just damage, inflammation, and scarring to the liver. Our normal kind of hepatocytes and cells are going to be kind of damaged and replaced by scar tissue and fatty fibro tissue. And obviously that kind of fatty fibro tissue does not do all the things that our liver cells do. And we generally have two major categories of cirrhosis, alcoholic and non-alcoholic. And the non-alcoholic fatty liver disease has a couple different names. The first one being NASH, or non-alcoholic steatohepatitis. It's also called NAFLD, for non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. From my understanding, these are pretty synonymous terms. But whatever the cause, we still have this process going on. Our liver is kind of getting destroyed and stopping functioning. Obviously, drugs can cause this. Everything we talked about previously also. If this is caught early, it can be completely reversible. If it's caught late, as a blanket statement, there's no cure. And generally, this is biopsy staged. So when a patient kind of first discovers whatever mechanism they might have this, oftentimes they'll be cared for by a GI doc or a hepatologist. And generally they get a biopsy of the liver to kind of look at how bad this process is. As our liver becomes less normal and we have more cirrhotic process going on, we lose the ability to flow blood through it like we normally would. And this is when our blood starts to take alternate pathways. You know, most of us can picture that diagram of the person with the swollen belly and all the extra veins, right? We can have caput medusa, which are swollen, painless veins around your umbilicus or belly button. The rectal veins often large. You get hemorrhoid bleeding from that. The esophageal varices and veins often enlarge, very scary, because if those rupture, it's extremely hard to control it all. It's often fatal. We get various shunting mechanisms that develop, and this kind of leads to that, you know, liver failure kind of picture clinically. And there's many, obviously, when you have this kind of moderate moving into severe hepatic dysfunction, it affects almost all our other organs, right? Because we don't have flow through just everything, you know, we have all sorts of pulmonary issues, cardiac issues, a lot of different things. But I want to pick one to talk about that's kind of interesting, and that's hepatic encephalopathy. And so hepatic encephalopathy, or HE, is a reversible syndrome observed in patients with advanced liver disease. And they can present with a wide range of neuropsychiatric abnormalities from substances accumulating within their brains, the most common one being ammonia. Generally, when we talk about this, it's, you know, the most common substance is that ammonia accumulation. And with this, you get confusion, personality changes, disorientation, decreased consciousness, and then eventually, if untreated, coma and death. Pretty interesting kind of thing. When we get this ammonia accumulation, we can get an interesting physical exam sign, and that's asterixis. And that is if you have the patient flex their wrists kind of upward and spread their fingers, they're going to have a tremor of their hand that looks like a bird flapping its wings or like somebody trying to play the piano in the air. And technically, this is a negative myoclonus due to a loss of postural tone. But you can also test it in a different way. Ask your patient to grip your hand, and they'll alternate between a tight grip and a loose grip. And it's pretty impressive if you ever see it in real life. So that's called asterixis. And hepatic encephalopathy is, we actually have a grading criteria for it, something called the Westhaven criteria. It's 1 through 4, 1 being the least bad, 4 being the worst, and the patient's in a coma. Now, this is pretty cool. And if you ever get a chance to see it, it's pretty incredible as treating somebody with this. How do we treat it? Well, we give them lactulose. And then sometimes if it's really bad and it's not fixed with that, we can use something called rifaximin, which is an antibiotic that messes with the GI bacterias that produce toxins that can worsen an HE. But lactulose is kind of the staple treatment for this. And it's a non-absorbable sugar that essentially makes you poop out very quickly all of the kind of extra NH4 plus and NH3. So getting rid of those ammonia byproducts. You give them this medication, lactulose, they have aggressive amounts of stool, and then they go from being confused and completely disoriented and changed to right back to normal. And it's pretty incredible to actually see. Wow. So if you ever see a patient who has hepatic encephalopathy, they get treated, it's a pretty incredible thing.
And the cause of the ammonia buildup is first damage to the liver that's not properly breaking down the ammonia, or what's going on? Yes, there?
Exactly. Yep. Our livers can't go through their normal kind of metabolic pathways, and it particularly as it pertains to like NH3 and NH4 plus metabolism and how that is cycled through our body, along with like breakdown products from amino acids.
Okay. Got it.
So let's back up now and go back to big picture. We have patients with liver dysfunction, and let's just talk about how generally are these patients managed? Well, you know, when we figure this stuff out, obviously they get a full workup, a full set of labs. They often get viral serologies to figure out, you know, all the hepatitis things and everything else. Is it a viral problem? They get ultrasounds, various scans. Findings may lead to kind of more deep workups, particularly if there is something like, you know, suspicion for hemochromatosis, then they're obviously going to get an iron panel and follow whatever leads kind of go down. They often get a biopsy, like we talked about, and get staged. And generally, you know, they're often just described as mild, moderate, or severe. But in more severe cases, they're often graded using one of several classification systems. And that's what I want to talk about next. And these include the MELD score and the Child-Pugh score. And first, I want to talk about the MELD score. The MELD, what it stands for, is the Model for End-Stage Liver Disease. And it's both of these scoring systems are trying to help stratify patients who need a liver transplant. So these are very sick people. And it functions kind of like a calculator. You can look it up on Google and pull it up on like MD Calc. The current version is MELD 3.0, and it was last updated last year in 2022. And so what do you put into it? Well, you put their age and sex along with five lab values, including creatinine, bilirubin, INR, albumin, and sodium. What is kind of interesting is that in 2016, it was changed from the MELD score to the MELD sodium score because they found that there was this weird association where patients with severe liver dysfunction had hyponatremia. They just had lower sodium. And to the best of my knowledge, the pathophysiology there is not well understood. But the lower their sodium, the worse their prognosis was and the sooner they needed a transplant. So they so much so that this association was found that it was made as part of the scoring for how fast they needed a transplant. So now it's MELD 3.0, but sodium is still part of that for that reason. The other score that's a similar function is Child's Pew. To the best of my knowledge, it's a little less commonly used as the updated MELD criteria have shown better evidence in their prognostic value of when determining when somebody needs a transplant. But it includes similar labs and also looks at if they have hepatic encephalopathy and ascites. So let's talk about our clinical evaluation of a patient who has some liver issues. You know, if they come in and we're starting to figure out what they have in the context of performing our stuff. So obviously you're going to do your full workup, a full subjective and objective evaluation. Questions that might be good in this are, you know, asking them about bleeding, right? You're trying to get a gauge of how, you know, generally it would be they'd have to be a pretty advanced or end stage, but you know, hey, similar to you treat somebody with a hematology questions, you know, that you bleed a lot when you cut yourself, you bruise easily, things like that, trying to get an idea of, you know, where their baseline is. You're going to be looking for things like ascites, history of problems, looking for edema, trying to get an idea of their fluid status, or, you know, if there's any obvious systemic problems like jaundice or other things that we've kind of mentioned or talked about. But in general, obviously, these patients hopefully will already be cared for by a professional, and you're going to want to consult and discuss this with their managing teams, you know, discuss, and especially in, you know, patients as we move into thinking about moderate to severe dysfunction, quadrant, you know, working a quadrant, just doing a few teeth at a time if you have to extract multiple ones, smaller appointments, and possibly in moderate dysfunction, but definitely in severe dysfunction, those patients should be treated in a hospital setting. Generally, with severe dysfunction, they, you know, if they're awaiting transplantation or their livers are pretty bad, remember, it makes all the coagulation proteins, except factor VIII and von Willebrand's, and their laboratory values for coagulation are all over the place. They fluctuate wildly because they essentially can't produce these in any predictable way. And so those are patients who you do not want to do surgery on with not in a hospital setting because it could go potentially very badly, very quickly. Okay. In terms of, and interesting to think as kind of a follow-up to that, coagulation factors and bleeding, most coagulation factors actually maintain full functionality at up to 20 to 30% of their normal levels. Meaning you could, you know, lose 70% of a single factor and most of the time it would still function normally within the cascade. So when, you know, people start to have those kind of issues, we're starting to talk about very kind of low levels. It's not like they're just losing a little bit. It's usually like, hey, we're at a 70 to 80% decrease before we can even start to see any clinical effects.
Got it.
Once we, go ahead.
Yeah. I don't know if you're going to touch on this, but as far as medications and things that we would administer to the patient, anesthetics, pain control, all that stuff, antibiotics.
Exactly. Yep. That is right where we're going, Grant. Yeah. So, yep. Hopefully the structure looks like it's working.
Cool.
Couple other weird physiologic notes before that. In end-stage liver disease, their circulation is all over the place. It's hyperdynamic. Generally, they have a lower blood pressure because they have all this physiologic shunting. They have increased cardiac output, a decreased systemic vascular resistance. So it's pretty unpredictable with, you know, how these patients are going to respond to anesthesia. Again, end-stage severe hospital setting. Obviously, we start messing with the circulation of the whole body. They're going to have a host of pulmonary issues, like, you know, they could have pulmonary hypertension or all these things. Obviously, it's interconnected, a lot of different issues. So with anesthesia, as a general rule, I think it's a safe statement to say that patients with mild liver dysfunction can be treated normally. They would still consult their doctors, but generally when they have mild liver dysfunction, they would, you know, physiologically behave like normal patients. Intraoperatively, patients with more severe dysfunction, if they have inadequate hepatocyte function, they can often need closer monitoring for some of the reasons I mentioned previously. Weirdly enough, a lot of times if problems can actually manifest as metabolic acidosis intraoperatively when the hepatocyte function gets really low. I'm not exactly sure why that is, but you know, you want to do things like intra-op monitoring with something like maybe a central line, A line, you know, being even considering regional techniques and trying to, you know, minimize the amount of general on the sicker patients. Volatile anesthetics are okay. Isoflurane is preferred as it has the least theoretic effect on hepatic blood flow. But all the volatiles are okay for these folks. Obviously, fluids are usually going to be an issue, especially in the moderate to severe patients. And I'm just touching on general before we get to, like, you know, kind of sedation stuff a little bit. We're going to lean more on maybe colloids, you know, as we kind of consider their fluid status, if they have a combination heart failure type picture. So that would be another consideration, like 5 or 25% albumin. From a specific medication perspective, propofol and ketamine are unaffected as long as the kidneys are normal. And as I talk about some of these medications, I'm presuming that the other organ systems are normal, particularly the kidneys. So just in terms of the drug metabolism, I'm not talking about if they had cardiovascular changes and you needed to counterbalance, you know, blood pressure along with this. But in general, propofol and ketamine are unaffected in their metabolism in somebody who has liver dysfunction. Benzos, benzodiazepines, are markedly prolonged. You can use them very low and titrate, but generally if I see something that's markedly prolonged in an organ system dysfunction, I tend to stay away from that medication personally, because the unpredictability of it. Similarly, dexmedetomidine or Presidex is hugely prolonged. So this is a stay away for me and somebody with hepatic problems. Opioid metabolism is reduced. We still commonly use it intra-op and post-operatively, but it's important to understand that the metabolism is reduced. So, you know, generally lower, I'll talk a little bit about post-op considerations. For example, post-operatively, we usually talk about using 50% of a dose that you would normally use for an opioid as a rough guideline. In terms of paralytics, just to mention it, succinylcholine is unaffected, but the non-depolarizing neuromuscular blockers are affected, like rocuronium and vecuronium. And so people with liver dysfunction, though, even though sux is okay if we need to, we usually talk about atricurium or cis-atricurium, which, if you remember, are degraded via Hoffman elimination in the plasma. So it kind of bypasses the liver for the elimination of those particular paralytic agents. Interestingly enough, nitrous oxide is unclear. There is some argument and some limited evidence that it may decrease blood flow to the liver. And there's also potentially associated vitamin B12 deficiencies in these patients with moderate to severe liver dysfunction. So in general, it's unclear, but I would probably be pretty careful with it. Or maybe in a patient with moderate dysfunction, if they're otherwise normal physiologically, it probably would be okay. But if I was going to use this, I'd probably check with their, you know, managing provider. Hey, you know, are you okay with me using nitrous? Because if they also have vitamin B12 or folate issues or deficiencies, you might want to be a little bit more careful with it. And then lastly, but probably kind of, you know, the thing that we all use, local. Right. So interesting. I did a lot of kind of digging in preparation for this, Grant, and there is really no hard numbers or guidelines on local kind of things. A lot of the kind of big thought considerations are, well, really consider Articaine, also known as Septicaine brand name, which is metabolized in the plasma. Great. We can bypass, you know, the liver system entirely. But in terms of lidocaine, there's no numbers that I could find. It's just, you know, the kind of the bigger the dysfunction, you have to be aware that it is going to be affected to some degree. I found one thing that recommended a lidocaine max dose of 300 milligrams, you know, as opposed to a normal, say, you know, 7 mg/kg. And I'm talking epi, you know, in the head and neck. So in general, I think the recommendation for most things is it's not necessarily a number with it. It's, hey, just be careful and, you know, consider like about half dose. And again, just in patients with moderate to worse liver dysfunction, those are patients who you might want to just limit your local dose to at least half of what you would do for somebody else. And, you know, maybe do those smaller appointments to try to kind of work through it.
Because you like lidocaine, for example, isn't or is broken down in the liver, we would just expect that to last longer because your liver function is not functioning enough to break it down. Or what other side effects could there be?
I think, you know, by decreasing the normal rate of metabolism and breakdown of it, you'd be more likely to get to a toxic threshold and see a local anesthetic toxicity faster than in a normal patient or at a lower dose or both.
Okay. But
I think that's the challenge is like, you know, we, even with like a biopsy, we try to say, is it mild, moderate, or severe? But there's so much gray area in there about how their liver is actually functioning, which is why there's not a lot of hard guidelines on these things, is because we don't really know what's going on. We try to use all these other labs and thoughts as surrogate markers for it, but that's why I think just being kind of conservative, especially in that moderate to severe category, is just probably the way to do it.
Yeah, and maybe leaning more towards articaine just because.
Yeah, definitely. Maybe you can use, you know, articaine is the major one you're going to use with a little augmenting with lidocaine if you have to. And then, so thinking kind of a little bit further, and we're getting toward the end here, one of the interesting things that opioids can cause is a spasm of the poidocoduodenal sphincter, which is that whole, you know, we talked about the sewer system draining from the liver, and then the gallbladder adds to it, it goes all the way down, the pancreas adds to it, and then it dumps into the duodenum. The sphincter I just mentioned, the choledochoduodenal sphincter, is also called the sphincter of Oddi, which is the last little sphincter before all this stuff dumps into the intestine. Opioids can cause that sphincter to spasm and shuts. And that can increase, you know, biliary tract pressure and can have issues. Fentanyl is actually the biggest offender in this. However, in our world and in what we're doing, it's not really an issue unless they have an acute problem with the biliary tract. So it'd be pretty unlikely outside of having an acute biliary tract issue for this to be a problem, but it is a known thing that you'll see. And, you know, I think what it more means that if you're on surgery taking care of these patients with acute biliary tract issues, you want to remember that opioids can make this worse or make a murky diagnostic picture. But in our world, from the doses that we use and without an acute issue, it's really not too much of an issue. It'd be pretty rare, I think, for it to happen. Post-op, and I'm not going to dive any more into bleeding issues. Obviously, if we're talking moderate to severe, then, you know, they could have just wild dysfunction and considering a hospital setting. Post-operative doses, let's talk about that. In general, the vibe is to just generally adjust things down. You can use acetaminophen if the patient does not use alcohol and you just cap it at 2 grams a day or less. So again, adjusted down, if you just kind of think about 50% or less for most of these things I'm going to mention, that's a pretty safe thing to do. In severe dysfunction of the liver, avoid Tylenol. But in mild to moderate, you still can use it if they do not drink alcohol. You want to stay away and avoid NSAIDs just entirely. They increase the risk of all those extra varices that they have of hemorrhaging. A lot of these patients do have associated renal issues. NSAIDs are just... don't use them, not in liver dysfunction patients. And again, there's definitely a caveat. If the patient just has very mild liver dysfunction, in my consult note, I would ask, hey, you know, is this patient okay to receive NSAIDs? In mild dysfunction, you can think about them mostly like normal. And I'm kind of more talking about that moderate to further progression patient here. For opioids, fentanyl and hydromorphone or Dilaudid are actually really good. You can consider a fentanyl patch at half the dose. You can use hydromorphone or Dilaudid orally at 50% of the dose. And one of the reasons that, like, you know, why are we leaning toward hydromorphone and Dilaudid? It's specifically also good in patients with renal failure. You can also use our normal kind of like oxycodone or hydrocodone, but you have to be very cautious. And similarly, a 50% reduction. So 50%, you're kind of seeing that number pop up a lot, right? And I would imagine and theorize that these recommendations are based on, like we talked about, there's just so much variability with the physiology. We're just trying to stay safe. As an adjunct for pain medicine, you can use gabapentin. That's renally cleared. So that can be a nice adjunct if you're, you know, really dealing with intense pain. Penicillins for antibiotics are okay. Those are renally cleared. Some antibiotics you want to stay away from include clindamycin and tetracyclines. It's probably also a good idea, I would recommend, in patients to moderate to severe liver dysfunction to consult their PCM or their managing provider about antibiotic use. Because in that patient population, they can actually be at a higher increased risk for bacterial endocarditis. So if you're doing a procedure or dealing with a minor infection that you may or may not put them on antibiotics, I would tend to be a bit more conservative and lean a little bit toward the antibiotics in this patient population, but also have that conversation just specifically because of that risk. What do you think, Grant?
Yeah, that's a good review of the various medications that you can and can't use, especially when they're getting towards moderate to severe liver dysfunction. I mean, as a provider, you should really do our homework to make sure that we know where their liver function is on that scale of mild, moderate to severe. Good stuff to use. I assume for mild and moderate, you touched on benzos, but if you're doing Versed and some fentanyl in your office, sounds like not a big deal in those patients, or what are your thoughts?
In somebody with moderate to greater liver dysfunction, personally, I would stay away from benzos because it's the metabolism gets prolonged in an unpredictable way. You could still, or if I was really wanting to reach for it and use it, I would potentially use a dose that's like 10 to 20% of what I might normally use. So let's say that patient that I would normally give between 3 to 5 milligrams, maybe I'll give half a milligram. I would probably feel comfortable doing that. But I would definitely lean a little bit heavier and on a fentanyl and propofol. Yeah.
Makes sense. Okay.
Yeah. Benzos are the one that I definitely want to be a little careful with. Or just ketamine instead of, go kind of down that route, assuming they're physiologically kind of capable of withstanding the sympathomimetic effects and the side profile of ketamine.
And then post-op antibiotics, you're thinking more penicillins as opposed to Clinda.
Yep.
And tetracyclines. Okay.
And just as a kind of follow-up note about it, for those of you at hospitals or in locations, because I just got to my just transferred jobs a few months ago, Grant, here. And the first thing I did was I went to the pharmacy and I got, actually one of my residents did it for me because they were fantastic. But I got the local antibiogram. I got that, last several years of testing that looks at the susceptibility of bacteria to antibiotics in our area and profile. And those exist for all locations that all of you listeners are at. And what we're seeing both in our region and a lot of my other military folks in various places around the country is the rates of resistance to clindamycin are increasing so much that a lot of us are almost not using it anymore. We're seeing just more and more resistance to clindamycin, which is leading me as this kind of second line agent to often lean toward doxycycline. Personally, I kind of like the spectrum, the profile, the general low amount of side effects that happen from it. And so I would encourage everybody, try to find your local antibiogram with that data, because and to particularly take a look at clindamycin, because if it's hugely ineffective against the common bacteria in your area, you may want to kind of figure out, break that dogma of, okay, they're penicillin allergic. Well, what are they going to get? They're going to get clindamycin. It might actually be better to reach for a different antibiotic based on what's actually in your area. So I would encourage everybody to kind of check that out. It's a smart way to practice, and I think we owe it to our patients to do that.
What's the typical dosage that you use for doxycycline?
I believe it is off the top of my head, 100 milligrams BID.
Okay.
I would need to check that though. I always reference anything before I prescribe it. But it's a pretty benign, well-tolerated antibiotic that affects it goes inside the cells. That's why it's effective for targeting some intracellular kind of pathogens. It has reasonable sinus coverage. The side effects, they can have things like photosensitivity and some other kind of rare side effects. But in general, it's pretty well tolerated and it's got a reasonable kind of spectrum. It's good against sinus bugs, unlike Clinda. And if I really need to, something kind of more concerned or don't feel like the spectrum is enough by itself, then you can always add on a second antibiotic to it. Something like metronidazole to get more of that anaerobic kind of gram-negative coverage.
Makes sense. Okay.
Doxycycline is an antibiotic I like a lot. So check it out. Do some research on your own. But yeah, find that antibiogram because that's going to make you a better provider, because I'm not sure that Clinda is near as effective as it used to be.
Yeah, that's a good tip for sure. Just the other day, I was looking with my staff about the Colorado, Denver area and the susceptibilities that are there. So
nice. That's
a good tip. Excellent. Is that the end of liver?
It is indeed, yes. Think through it a little bit. Obviously, is the major cornerstones for all our discussions. Reach out and talk with their managing folks. Try to gather that data on them. And, if somebody in that, probably the hardest category for folks listening, I would imagine, is going to be that moderate category, because mild is essentially normal. Severe, they're going to be in the hospital and really ill usually. So it's that moderate kind of patient that might be the most difficult. Let them know your plan. Hey, I'd like to sedate the patient using these kind of medications for these reasons. The more communication that you have with them, the better care you can provide with the patient.
I like that a lot. I think most of us, just when we hear anyone, a patient say they have liver disease or issues, we're thinking bleeding. But it's good to hear there's a lot, because the liver has so many other functions. There's a lot of things that we should be aware of, with medications we're prescribing, to other manifestations and things that it can cause in their body. So really, really good review. I appreciate you doing that.
Thanks. Yeah, no, my pleasure. Hopefully it's helpful to all the folks listening, and stay motivated and curious out there and keep diving into medicine and anesthesia.
Yep, that is so great. All right, well, I'll put your contact info as well as mine in the show notes in case listeners have further questions. But yeah, I look forward to connecting with you with more medicine topics.
Sounds great, Grant. Take care.
You too. Talk to you later. Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Everyday Oral Surgery. For more information on these podcasts, please visit everydayoralsurgery.com. I love feedback and would be very grateful if you would reach out to me via my email, grantstuckey@gmail.com, and let me know what you thought of this episode. Or you can text me at 720-441-6059. Additionally, if you have any topics you'd like to hear about, or if you would like to be a guest on the podcast, please, please email or text me. I found many of my interviewees through people who have been contacting me and have been listening, and I've gotten so many great ideas for more podcasts, and that's what helps keep the podcast rolling. So really appreciate you making that extra effort and helping me out with feedback and knowing what to do next on the podcast. Thank you so much.